You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Hello, how are we doing today?
We are well, thank you for asking.
Joel has spoken for all of us. We are indeed well, which is always nice to hear.
Wellness is great. So, what do we have today for science news?
Oh, let me tell you. Science is happening, and we're going to start with ants.
Ants. Starting small.
Oh, not small at all, it turns out, because these little buggers like to hang out together. But before we get into this paper, I want to talk about ant facts, because ants are badass, okay? Wow. I'm not going to lie. So I'm going to run a few things. The bullet ant. It has the most painful bite in the world. Okay? One ant fact. Ant fact number two. Longest living insect. Some can be up to 30 years.
Oh my God. That ant could take out a mortgage and have kids and a family.
Well, not in Auckland, but... Number three ant fact. They can carry 50 times their body weight. So this would be like if one of us like just picked up a couple of utes, put it on the back, and went to town.
Wow, that's insane.
Oh, get ready
Starting
for
strong.
Get number four ant fact. The tree jaw ant can jump 100 times its body length. So that would be like if you were to jump on top of the PwC building here in the Auckland CBD.
Is that like high jump or long jump?
High jump.
Wow. Oh, I don't know if I want to see an ant jumping that far off the ground.
Yeah, it actually uses its mouth to do it, too.
I'm a little concerned about the super ant.
It's a super ant. These are just ants. Ants are just super.
I'm petrified because I don't like ants, so this is off to a terrible start.
How can
start
you not like
me?
Ants after all these great ant facts?
I feel like they give off evil vibes, and if they were the size of humans, they'd be a little bit too powerful.
I mean, haven't you seen A Bug's Life?
I didn't like A Bug's Life.
Oh, it was a great documentary.
The Royal Family.
All right. Let's get to ant fact number five, which is where this paper comes in, and it's that ants can survive floods for months just by hanging out together on top of the surface.
And there was no disclosed interest around any ant lobby groups or anything like that?
No.
This
no.
is all independent. Wow.
They don't quite have the power yet for that. But that's what we're concerned about, is how they group together, strength in numbers. Mm. So what this study did is it actually just videotaped ants on a surface to see how this happens. Because one ant in a flood is not going to survive. But if what can happen is they can get hundreds of ants that can just hang out on top of each other, form very distinct layers, and it can actually change its shape based on the flow of the fluid itself to reduce drag.
Wow.
And help it survive longer. So what this study actually did is that they were able to just track ants. So they would videotape different ants on the surface, and if you had just like two, three, four of them, they wouldn't actually associate with each other. They didn't care. They would run into each other and then actually just punch each other in the face and try to go their separate ways. Mm. But when there was more than 10 of them, then they actually started to form these rafts that would also help them survive in the wild. And so what the researchers came up with is it's not because ants are super smart and can form these rafts. They're actually kind of dumb. They don't actually hang out when given the opportunity. Mm. But when we reach this magic number, they can, and they think it's what's called the Cheerios effect.
Oh, I'm starting to get it.
Yeah.
Because I'm picturing a bowl of Cheerios right now, and I can absolutely picture them sticking together.
You can picture ants in the bowl of Cheerios.
Yeah. You.
This is my worst nightmare.
Yes.
I feel like this is getting really scary again.
So when you have the last bowl or the last of your Cheerios in the bowl and the milk, you'll have like two or three, and they always seem to stick together, right?
Mm.
So what happens is that they're actually just making little tiny dents on the surface of the milk, and so whenever they're close to other dents, they kind of combine. So it's the physics of the fluid itself rather than ants being super smart. And given enough time, once you have an ant conglomeration that's 10 or more, then it can start to form these rafts that can actually help it survive for months in a flood.
Wow. And what's the kind of, what differentiates 9 ants from 10 ants being that magic kind of point where the fluid allows that to happen?
Right. So it all came down to the modeling of the physics involved and the fluid dynamics that 10, with the hydrophobic material that these ants are kind of made of, which means they actually repel water. Mm. So once they had 10 of them together, it crossed the threshold and it was able to conglomerate up to things. In this study, they looked at 158 ants altogether. Mm. And so it was very self-sustaining as well. So if you lose some ants, like, that's fine. They can always keep things going.
Is this all ants or just certain types? But I guess it's the, yeah, the water fluidity. Oh, fluidity.
This was, they looked at this specific species of ants. And so I think further research should look at more ants because they're cool. I think we have now established definitively, objectively, that ants are cool.
It's a good thing they're stupid.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like my position on ants is, it's coming around after learning less. Because, I don't know, they still freak me out. And
what's with ants, specifically?
I think it's because one time I broke open a peach and there were just a pile of ants inside the peach.
Mm.
And I don't know, I love peaches and I hate ants already. So that was kind of a massive magnification of that extreme
put you over the top.
Feeling. Yeah.
Well, fun thing to visualize for you then will be that ants, when they do conglomerate like this, actually do have properties of both solid and liquids. So you could actually pour ants out of a teapot if you wanted to.
Now I can't drink tea anymore. So that's peaches, cereal, and tea off the table for me.
Someone must have come up with that idea. Like, ant tea. Let's try it and just see if it works.
Sure enough. Ants could do anything, really. I think this is what we're learning.
That is really, really fascinating. Oh, my God.
All right, let's talk about some more fascinating things. Since we are in a... We're on the radio, right? You play music. Let's talk about music. We just listened to some music coming in here, which was pretty catchy.
It was. Thank you, Molly.
Yes, big time. So what they've actually been able to do now is use music as a way to test for cognitive decline.
Oh.
So cognitive decline, it's really important to get early detection because then you can actually use treatments and prevent some of this severe dementia that occurs. But the current methods aren't super great. You might have someone just ask you, like, what's the day of the week? Or have them recite the alphabet in reverse. Mm. It's just a simple task like that. But this has a high risk for bias, and it's not good at early detection. Like, let's for instance, if you didn't grow up speaking English, if you had to then recite the English alphabet in reverse, there could, of course, be opportunity for bias. And it also can be somewhat dehumanizing to have someone ask you these kind of questions as well. So what these researchers want to do is to develop a method that's more objective and that can be something that can detect earlier onset of this type of cognitive decline and something that's just a little bit more fun, I guess.
I'm concerned I might be misdiagnosed if I get asked to sing.
So how this works is they looked at 82 participants, so still a relatively small study, but they played music for them and they had them try to identify melodies or denote when a certain instrument was being played. So every time a violin would play, then they would make a register a note. Mm. And so while doing this, they're able to actually connect electrodes just on the outside of their forehead, and they're able to measure their brain waves and see how exactly their brain was responding to this musical stimuli.
Is this likely to be different between musicians and non-musicians?
Probably. That's a great question, and something that they did not actively address in the study, as it is kind of a smaller pilot study, proof of concept, to see if this could work. But I like where your scientific head is at.
Casper is all the professionalism.
I don't have a single ant fact on me.
We all
but
have
when it
strips.
Comes to music, you got it.
So what did they find?
So they found that this test actually is effective and that they were able to distinctly identify control subjects like young and healthy people from those that were elderly and were at the beginning onset of this type of decline from what their tests said, meaning that this could be a non-invasive test that we could use to detect early onset of cognitive decline. And importantly, the people that underwent the test found it pleasurable.
You just get to listen to some music and yeah. But I guess my kind of concern here is if you're asked to listen out for a violin, what's stopping people with, you know, awful hearing from kind of not having that stimulus?
Definitely would be something that might convolute the results, of course. So something that they'd probably want to investigate further. But what they did is they were able to look at the specific electrical signals in the brain that they actually used machine learning to deconvolute that. So when you think of an EEG, which is the output, is just like, think of that, those charts with
the lines
going back. Like, it can be somewhat complicated. So they had to use some techniques to kind of suss out exactly what signals were important. And I mean, theoretically, if you can hear that what they are proposing is that should be consistent across people.
Thank God, because my hearing is terrible, but I like to think I still have my cognitive function as someone who's 21. But I guess we'll find out if I ever do this test. What's our final topic for today?
Final topic today is going to be a little bit scary, because...
Scarier than ants?
I think it's scarier than ants.
Okay, but the bar is really low.
The bar is really low. All right, we're going into microplastics.
Okay, that is scary.
That's pretty scary.
Bit of perspective, yeah.
And honestly, we could probably have a microplastics paper every week if we wanted to, just because we're learning more and more, and it's scarier.
We probably eat a paper of microplastics every week.
Mm.
Yeah, or breathe it.
Yeah. Oh, true.
Ooh. If you'd like to know more about breathing in microplastics, I encourage you to check out the TEDx this weekend held at the University of Auckland campus.
Weekend plans are sussed, Casper.
Yes.
Is that what we're doing?
That was a plug for my own talk.
Very excited for that.
Very excited. All right. But now let's talk about somebody else's research on microplastics, where we actually saw in a study the microplastics being transferred up in the food chain. So this study looked at, they put microplastics in some soil, and then they planted some lettuce. And they took that lettuce, they fed it to some insects. And they took those insects and they fed it to some fish. And they found microplastics every step of the way.
Wow.
And at the very end, the super ants were made of 99% microplastics.
That's what gave them their strength.
That's terrifying. So just from the soil, that can go all the way through to things that we eat. And presumably if anyone ate me, for example, then that would kind of be more microplastics.
So
they never exit the chain at any point.
Right. They're everywhere. Mm. They're literally everywhere.
I guess the question many people might have is, are there certain foods that I am eating that might have more microplastics in them than others?
Yeah, great question. So a lot of the early studies would, things that looking at fish in the marine environment, we know plastic is all over the ocean, so that's where people focused. Mm. But this study would suggest that it's not just fish, for instance, that might have microplastics, but plants too. So if you're a vegetarian, you only eat lettuce, like the bugs in this study, they still had microplastics in them.
Wow. That's terrifying. No salads are safe.
Nowhere is safe.
Mm. And yeah, so you've got your microplastics from presumably landfills kind of leaching into soil and stuff. How can we kind of keep ourselves safe from this kind of thing? Or is it just bad news all around?
This is where it gets scary.
Yeah, okay.
Is that plastics are everywhere. Everywhere. We have found them on the top of the tallest mountains to the deepest parts of the ocean. We've found them on remote islands. We've found them on the snow in Antarctica. Everywhere scientists have looked, they've found microplastics.
Do we know how recently they got there? If this is like you know, a new development, or if it's, you know, something we've been sort of leeching for a long time? Or?
Well, the thing about plastics is their lifetime in the environment is hundreds of years. So we don't know when they were released, but we know since 1950 for sure. And they're likely going to be around for hundreds of years. So that's why it's important for us to try to reduce the amount of waste that we produce.
We're all kind of like, yeah, I don't know if you can see us. Obviously, we're on the radio, but we're all kind of dumbfounded. We're sitting here. And that was a really grim final story. And I guess
I feel like it's one of those topics that just feels insurmountable.
Yeah, I guess.
Well, there are things we can do, which, of course, would be to stop producing so much plastic. We're actually producing it exponentially, meaning if we created the same amount of plastic next year as we did this year, that would be a huge improvement if we just flatlined. But we're actually increasing the amount of production, and we're supposed to triple the amount of plastics on Earth by 2050. So if we just cut down on that and came up with some more reusable types of solutions, rethink our problems, and improve our recycling, because less than 10% of all plastic gets recycled.
Shocking. That's a, yeah, I guess, final message for all you listeners out there. Try and limit your waste consumption, so that the scariest thing you can talk about on Dear Science is my irrational fear of insects or whatever else you guys might have brewing. But yeah.
Well, thank you, Joel, for this week's topics. And if anyone's interested, do check out his TEDx this weekend. If you're scared about the microplastics, maybe it'll be a little more of a hopeful note. Maybe it won't. But do check it out. And yeah, thank you so much.
Oh, don't thank me. Thank the ants.
And thank you, Motet.
Thank you, Motet.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.